This is the top left corner at the Greylock Glass. And this is episode 157 of the top left corner here on the Greylock Glass, greylockglass.com. I'm your host, Jay Velasquez, and as always, I do thank you for tuning in, whether you're listening on your commute, whether you're cleaning the house, taking the dog for a walk, however it is that you put us between your ears, I thank you. It means a lot to us that you're here with us 7+ years later. This episode is special because, well, they're all special, but this one is especially special because it is the third and final part of a three-part series that interviews each of the candidates for the Williamstown Select Board's 2 seats that are up for grabs. So get that. You get 2 seats. You get 3 candidates. When the music stops, whoever doesn't have a seat, well, that's musical chairs for you. So we've heard from first Randall Fippinger, and then we heard from Bilal Ansari. Today we're going to be hearing from Jane Patton, who has been, this will be her, if she wins, this would be her 4th term, 3-year term on the select board. And she says, win or lose, this is the last time she's running. So we might have given her a couple of extra minutes because, let's face it, she's been there for 9 years now, and it's kind of hard not to explore certain issues with people who have, like, you know, been right there at the hub of that wheel. I have to have an apology to make because the audio on my end just sucked. And frankly, I'm not exactly sure what's going on, but I think it has to do with my microphone, which is, I've had it since the very beginning. I've had it for 7 years now, and it's, you know, recorded hundreds and hundreds of hours. It's been just a workhorse, and it's probably dying, as various equipment does die. You knew that my computer died last year. This is no different. If you want to help us keep from falling apart like the Black Pearl, you know, the Pirates of the Caribbean, the sort of ragtag falling apart ship. This is kind of like that. This is kind of like a pirate ship, this little ragtag news organization. And, you know, I wouldn't say that the boat's leaking, but, you know, it could use some pitch and polish here and there. Please consider helping us out. This is your local news. You know, I do this for you. If you're listening, it's because you care about local issues, events. And if you care about local issues and events and you want to hear about it in long form, right? We're not talking 30-second sound clips. We're not talking 2-minute sound clips. We're talking an hour-long interview with the candidates. No one else is giving that to you. Okay, just nobody. So if you want to help keep that kind of in-depth news alive, please visit greylockglass.com/membership. And join up at whatever level you can afford, either $5 a month, $10 a month, $100 a month, whatever you think it's worth and whatever fits your budget. If a monthly membership is not for you, by all means, you can look around. You'll see links to PayPal. You'll see links to donate to cryptocurrency, links to just throw a dollar in the hat if that's what you got. Trust me, if there was a way to like digitally send us like, you know, chickens or cows or potatoes or something, whatever, we'd take it. But in this case, currency is where it's at and we need it. So please, greylockglass.com/membership to keep this show alive. Now, it's a long interview. We delve deeply into these issues, so we should probably get right to it. I just should let you know that this episode is sponsored by Shakespeare & Company's 45th season. Tickets on sale now, shakespeare.org. And you can go there and buy tickets to The Approach, which opens next month, or any other show that they've got going on. All right, with that, let's get right to the show. And with me on the line is Jane Patton, who is running for a 4th term as a select board member here in Williamstown. Jane, thank you so much for coming on the Top Left Corner.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, it's exciting. I really have neglected Williamstown
to be honest. I've focused a lot on North Adams in the last couple of years because they had their issues as well as any town, I suppose. But I often wonder if I've just been shy because I live here and I don't want to muddy the waters too much where I live. But I guess you have to eventually just dive right in and get into the thick of it. And we've had a pretty thick couple of years here in Williamstown, have we not?
I think that's a gracious way of putting it. Sure.
Yeah. Well, before we get to that, I know that most of our listeners know who you are. They know, I believe you're the general manager at the Taconic Country Club, a golf club, yes?
I am.
And they know that you have been on the select board for 3 terms now. Why don't you, for just those people who don't know you, just give us a sense of your backstory, your origin, your superhero origin story. And as we were talking about in the green room, why are you running for a 4th term?
Well, let's see. My superhero backstory. I grew up in a town outside of St. Louis, Missouri. Most of my family is still there. I credit my dad and my 3 brothers for pretty much everything I am today. They made me tough and resilient. So I have mad love for them. My entire work background prior to here was in direct-to-consumer catalog. I was early adopter in that in the late 80s, and over time left St. Louis and worked for some fairly big names companies, J. Peterman, Sundance Catalog out in Utah, Bloomingdale's, and Victoria's Secret. I also worked for the Vermont Country Store up in Manchester when we first came back. I moved to Williamstown in 2000 to work for a company called Aziba, founded by a Williams professor and some of his students, among others. And in later that year, I met my now wife, Emily Aiken. We spent about 6 or 7 years in New York City working. We kept our house up here originally in Adams. When I was 16 years old, I went on a school trip to New York and on top of the World Trade Center deck, told my history teacher that I would live and work in New York one day. And he looked at me in his very droll way and said, "Ms. Patton, young ladies from St. Charles, Missouri, do not live and work in
And that's
Manhattan."
all it took to
Pretty
set
much.
your course. Yeah, hey, that happens a more often than not. The people who say, no, you can't do that, they don't always know who they're talking to, do they?
No, especially not in this particular case. So Em and I came back in 2008 and moved into Williamstown. In 2009, our twin girls were born. I had the opportunity to stay home with them for a bit while Em focused on her career, which was just a luxury for me because I was not able to do that with my son, who is now 29. The girls go to Mount Greylock. This is their first year there. Seems to be the assimilation has been good. And then starting in about 2013, Em was ready for me to stop living that life of leisure, although twin 4-year-old girls are not exactly leisurely. And I started looking around for things to do. There was an opening on the select board, so I ran. I also started working with the Williamstown Theater Festival because I have a huge love for theater and other consulting jobs around town. And then in late 2016, I started here at Taconic, which just melded it, something I love to do with all of my skill, background. And it's been wonderful. This is the 6th season that I've been here. So, all good,
Well,
all very good.
I appreciate your work. If only, because I don't golf and I probably never will, but I sure like fireworks. So I appreciate your work putting that together.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, I should keep that in every bio. That's going to be, I think, my legacy more than any other thing
Hey, you know,
that I do.
it is a crowd pleaser. It is, anybody who can make You know, a couple thousand people say ooh and ah at the same time. You know, that's there's a power to that. Can you? Here's a question. And I know this is maybe using the power of my microphone a little bit too much. Can you get us a discount on the Vermont crackers? Do you still have any connections there?
I do not. I'm no. so sorry.
Well, let's do it. Because, you know, because I don't mind driving up there to get them. I probably wouldn't think to order them, you know, because it's, you know, half the fun is going there. But if somebody were to just like have a couple of cases in their garage at all times, I would probably, you know, sneak around and put a, you know, a fiver in your palm. So I asked.
Good to know.
You know, just Vermont crackers, they're really addictive. If anybody doesn't know, they're these huge like soup crackers, they're like oyster crackers, but like on steroids. I love them. So the question that I did not ask Randall, but I should probably ask you, but I did ask Bilal, is if Williamstown were a person, who would it be?
Yeah, you know, I saw that in Bilal's transcript, and I was thinking about that. I don't think I could make it one person. I think Williamstown, especially right now, in that there's a, I don't know the whole story, but there's something about every time you step into a river, you know, the river is different, even if you step into it at the same spot every time. Williamstown is constantly evolving, especially right now, and with the work the college is doing, and we get a new 500 kids who start every freshman year, their freshman year, that are here for 4 years and make their impact, and college's interest in diversity and equity in terms of the student population has an impact. And so, you know, I liked Bilal's analogy, but a person. I don't know many people who change that much and evolve and grow and get bigger and smaller and run faster and slower depending on the environment around them.
So a river. You're going to go. Yeah. Your answer is a river. Maybe there's a river goddess a river. No, we can do that. And I think that's a really well. It's an apt description because you can drive through this town. And people, you know, people tell me this all the time. They have, you know, they vacationed here 10 years ago, or they had their honeymoon here, whatever. And they'll talk about how they were gone just for a few years and they're back to visit and it's changed. And I'm like, really? I don't see it. But that's in part because we're here. We don't always see those changes. We don't always feel that. And that's probably a good thing for the most part, because we have discovered that change is controversial. It can be, you can have growing pains associated with change, and it can be uncomfortable for people who do not appreciate change. And that has been one of the subjects of conversation these last couple of years. In particular, we spent some time on this with both other candidates, so we kind of have to touch on it here. The Dyer Committee was a force that really drove some conversation. And, you know, many people will probably attribute it, some of the change that occurs to the Dyer Committee and other people in the community who were part of this, sort of the movement for diversity, equity, and inclusion. What are your thoughts on the last couple of years? What are your thoughts on the Dyer Committee? Do you think it achieved what it set out to do? Yeah, anything that you care to comment on, given that you worked with them pretty closely as the select board.
So, you know, I think depending on where you were at in the process and at what level you were engaged or one was engaged, the impressions are going to be vastly different in terms of what was accomplished, what wasn't accomplished, you know, worked, didn't work, et cetera. The things about Dyer that I am very pleased about, with a caveat, is I think our first conversations in town about the racial equity issues, certainly raised at the select board, were, early June, the first or second, maybe the first meeting after the just horrific murder of George Floyd. And I'll speak for myself, although I'm confident the whole board felt this way, were overwhelmed by the comments. And I personally was shocked to hear the things that people had experienced. I found it very disturbing, disheartening. I was not in a place of denial. I was really more in a place of, oh my gosh, how could we have not known about this? And we had subsequent meetings off cycle to allow more conversations. And I was I had cycled on to chair that May. So I was the chair of the select board at the time, and in talking with the vice chair and the town manager at the time, I said, you know, we need to form a committee, an advisory committee, to hear about these things and find out what's going on and you know, have a pull together a group. And we did that, and we did it with really, I think, unprecedented swiftness in terms of town government moving on things like this. I believe by the July 13th meeting, so really a month, we had interviewed and spoke with folks who either put their name forward or their names were put forward, and named the committee, and were ready to, you know, roll up our sleeves and get started on it. So in that regard, I view that as a significant success. The caveat is, I don't know if, you know, taking a little bit more time would have been more prudent in terms of fully identifying exactly what we hoped would come of the committee, formulating our thoughts more. I think it was our second meeting or third when we heard about the lawsuit, which was devastating. And by devastating, I mean just utter shock that this was going on and had been going on for some time and having absolutely no idea about it. Again, I don't know, I can't say exactly what might have been done differently informing Dyer had we known that information, but it certainly did not put any of us on any kind of solid, comfortable footing. You know, the hope that we had in the first meeting was pretty quickly
tempered,
tarnished. Well, tempered, tarnished by now there's questions of, okay, we've got issues of transparency or lack of transparency in the police department. What about the select board? And the select board is just, you know, kind of like, what is going on? None of us had been through anything approaching anything like this. We are getting tons of questions and criticisms from residents. We're getting hit on the other side from town council who are like, there's a way to do this, and, you know, just scaring you to death for fear of, you know, doing or saying the wrong thing, which is their job, but, you know, didn't make the situation any easier. And so I think from the jump, as soon as that piece happened, it made the dire climb, that, you know, the path to to what we had hoped we might eventually get to. It really knocked the wind out of everybody, I think, and knocked us off course a little bit.
Do you feel like the work of the Dyer Committee made any headway in the hearts and minds department?
I do. I don't know how many it did. It certainly did with me. I told somebody a story not that long ago about sitting with some longtime Williamstown residents who were, you know, like, how can this be? And I don't get it. And I was really starting to research more into just, you know, systemic bias, unintentional bias, not realizing that things we had grown up with or phrases that we had grown up with that were inherently especially racially biased. And those moments where you just kind of, you know, hit yourself on the side of the head and you're like, oh my gosh, that's crazy. I have used this phrase forever. I had no idea. It never occurred to me what the origin of the phrase was, because it was so, you know, commonplace. And then when you kind of take a minute and, you know, and say, okay, let me try to hear and feel and see a different perspective on this thing. Even as I'm telling you this, I kind of get shivery on my arms, because that's how I felt at that moment where I went, right, oh my gosh. And so I have been trying in my own ways. I'm not really a soapbox person. I'm always floored that anyone ever really cares about what I have to say. But I have tried in my way, on an individual basis, to try to show people how my journey has progressed and invite them to consider doing the same. You know, there's an opportunity here for people who, you know, I get when you're frustrated, but there, you know, there were times when there was an opportunity to educate. And instead, maybe you were belittled or ridiculed because you were uneducated. And I'm trying to make it a point not to do that to anybody else.
Right.
I want to invite people to be open to the idea rather than be like, what's wrong with you? Why don't you know this? It's more, hey, let me talk to you how I got here.
No, I think that that's an approach that's going to work really well with some people. And I think that while, you know, the nation as a whole is way behind the eight ball when it comes to, you know, fixing this, I think that the fact of the matter is you have to figure out each person just about what's it going to take. I mean, the reason I ask this question is because you can have policy, right? You can create programs, you can bring in consultants, you can do all kinds of things, and each of them will, you know, be good for, you know, what they're worth. But it is the individual. For example, we have ample evidence that financial institutions, from large ones to local banks, they do not approve loans, nor do they do business with, say, businesses of color. And even when you account for everything, all the variables, the same loan that would have been, you know, applied for by a white business, owned business, is rejected for no other consideration. And therefore, you have to say, well, they each had a degree from a college, a respectable college. They each had a good business plan. They each, you know, had a presentation that was well done. End of the day, why did this person get it and why did this person not get it? And it's staggering. I mean, the results are staggering, and it's costing, by some estimates, it's costing the country, and Massachusetts is a lot, millions and millions and millions and millions of dollars because of the business that's not happening. The commerce. So even if you just cared about commerce, you should want equity because equity creates GDP. So that's my soapbox right there. You mentioned the police department, and I want to get to that because that's tied up in all this, obviously. But my main concern is the point of transparency that you brought up. There are some who have criticized the select board for not leaning on, I guess it would be the town manager, and having the town manager lean on the police department for greater transparency. Some still criticize the decision not to be more forthcoming about how the whole let's make a list of troublemakers in Williamstown, how that occurred. They feel like that there really could be more coming out of that. And there is a big question mark about what happened to the conversations that were supposed to be geared toward what kind of police department do we want to have? Three women, three conversations. What will they reveal to each other? And what does each have to hide? Shakespeare and Company in Lenox, Massachusetts presents The Approach by acclaimed Irish playwright Mark O'Rourke. The Sunday Independent calls it a stunning new play, immaculate. The Guardian describes it as a 60-minute jewel. You can eavesdrop May 6th through May 29th. Tickets are on sale now at shakespeare.org. And this is one of the reasons why you say you want this fourth term, because this is a mess you inherited, a mess you were dealing with, and this is a mess that you don't want to pass on without trying to take a crack at it and seeing what you can do to resolve some of these issues. In your mind, where are we with the police department examining its past behavior, its present makeup, and its future, I guess, sort of priorities?
There's a lot to unpack there.
Yeah, I know. Sorry about that.
No, it's all good. So I think one of the things that became pretty clear, so we had the committee that met last year and on the, you know, the search committee, and there was a falling out of sorts, and folks were very upset with the town manager, and some committee members quit in protest, or advisory search committee members. And I think what we got to then was the town manager, the permanent town manager, really has to be part of the process of hiring the permanent police chief. And at the same time, the select board in about October got to two candidates for the new town manager, both of them having lots of positives about them, but neither kind of being the full package. And so we did not go with either of those two. So the police chief search has been delayed further. I will make this extraordinarily clear. In every interview I had, in both sessions, back in the fall and the one we just completed, every candidate was asked by me if they understood that while they are the hiring authority of the police department, and they the town manager has the sole responsibility of firing a police chief, that the events of the past, the lack of transparency of the past, would no longer be acceptable, certainly not by me. And given the situation, I was pretty confident, not by any member of the select board, for hopefully ever. The communication regarding police performance, regarding any issues, I mean, that stuff honestly never came up. And that was one of the aha moments for me, which was you have got to ask more questions. You have got to probe and probe and peel away at that onion and make sure that people understand that some kind of pro forma report is no longer what this board wants. And I believe that that's where we're at. The new guy, and I'm happy to report last night, we approved his contract. He's starting on July 1st. His name is Bob. I'm going to mess it up, but I'll take a stab at it. Like Maricone, he has a lot of experience in community relations and DEI and so forth that made him a really compelling candidate for this job. He understands that he owes the select board this kind of transparency that we're looking for, and having him be part of the hiring process now and, you know, taking ownership, if you will, feeling he's got skin in the game in terms of getting the right chief in here, other than this is the chief, you know, and that's not, I also don't need anyone to, I hold Chief Zimba in high regard. I think he has handled himself with extraordinary grace throughout all of this. I do think we have to have a search. We cannot do this without a search. I've never been in favor of not having a search because it's too critical. And so that's where I think we're going to be starting at a whole different place with this new town manager and ultimately the permanent police chief, that they understand that transparency at a bare minimum is absolutely critical.
The search for a new police chief, when would you like to see a final name?
Oh my gosh. Well, I'm going to say as soon as possible, which is way too vague.
In six months, a year?
At the most, you know, it's probably time to have the conversation about restarting some kind of group discussion about what we're looking for. Across all manner of voices in town, you know, more of this, less of that. We're in the process of the accreditation. We're in the process of the work with the SPC, making sure that we are able to quantify what it is that the town of Williamstown needs for their next chief. We are, you know, we're not a Boston or a Springfield. We're not a Pittsfield in terms of the different layers of activity, criminal activity that those towns have to deal with. We are kind of on a natural corridor, which is why there's a fair amount of, you know, drug issues that go on. But, you know, what do we want? I think it's possible that we end up looking at things and maybe we reallocate some funds from one bucket in the budget to another bucket that focuses more on the, you know, the social work aspect. When you hear the statistics of the number of calls really in every town that are more mental health related than criminal activity and someone in distress, and then it escalates because, you know, they're in distress.
One out of four.
Right. It's crazy.
Let's switch, though, to another issue that is going to affect life in Williamstown for generations. It is RR2 zoning. The question of how many, how big, how close in, What is your understanding of the reasoning behind decreasing lot size, increasing a number of units? What's driving this?
Well, there's always an ongoing conversation about opportunities for, you know, housing that is affordable for people. Affordable housing is another one of those phrases that folks immediately jump, you know, to a conclusion. And a long time ago, two town managers ago, Peter Follin said to me, "We need affordable housing for sure, but what we really, really need is housing that is affordable for, you know, the average person." Williamstown has this gloriously bucolic setting. There's green everywhere we look. We have been extremely prudent and mindful in terms of conservation, whether it's agricultural or permanent conservation or, you know, what have you. I know there is a lot of, feeling and emotion around this and fear, right? Because it's change. I know there are folks who say, well, why rush? You know, this new plan, the comprehensive plan, will be done sometime next year. I kind of go, in any of these zoning changes, if they happen, can be undone if it turns out this is a horrible idea. Permanent conservation can't be undone. Some of these other things that we do to preserve the land can't be undone. The zoning can be, if necessary.
You're not going to undo 50 houses that get put up in a development in South Wilmington. You're not going to undo them if that turns out to be a bad idea. You know, you're not going to undo a hundred unit housing, you know, complex. I mean, you're not going to kick people out of their homes and tear down the buildings if it's a bad idea. So how do you mean you're going to undo this if it's? I mean, you're basically saying go back to the town and redo the bylaws again.
What I'm trying to say very simply is it's not permanent. I think the chances of 100 home development anywhere in Williamstown is extremely unlikely. I think that is people who, you know, are fearful of change or don't want the landscape around them to be vastly different than it is today. I don't know if you were here in 2016 when Wabika was petitioning to be able to be rezoned to perhaps have a
conference center. Yeah, I was
hotel, and people went crazy. There were people who were just, I mean, that's the last time I think we've been this divided. I, just my luck, I was the chair that year as well. And the way I view it is, we're trying to make zoning changes that are perfect for everybody, or perfect for the town, and the reality is, that's not realistic, you know?
I think it will be perfect for somebody. I think it will be perfect for developers. I think it'll be ideal for a developer who wants to put up a property maybe worth $2.5, $3 million. I think it'll be perfect for that clientele. I don't think it'll be perfect for, housing that's affordable for people. I don't see... Given how much land stock is available, and I used to be a tax assessor, so I know a little bit about this. Given the amount of available housing stock, I don't see any houses that are going to be built that are going to list for under $500,000. That's just not going to happen. And probably the few houses that might get built are going to be probably closer to the $1 million mark. So I don't actually see affordable housing or housing that's affordable as the main driver. Change my mind. I would love to have you change my mind.
I don't think I can change your mind. My point of view on this is this stems from, again, people being afraid of change. I understand that a house at, you know, $500,000-$600,000 is not affordable housing for most people. I am not in favor, however, of putting off change in perpetuity because we're afraid of what that change might bring. I don't believe, I don't know where anybody would build a development of that kind. I just think it's a little bit of people are afraid of it. 2023 will come. If we wait for the comprehensive plan, maybe there'll be answers there that make people more comfortable with the idea. Chances are pretty good it won't. So it feels like one of those issues.
Okay, so why do we have this 15-year plan, this comprehensive plan? It's going to be here in 13 months or so. It seems to me, based on what people have told me, that quite a bit of that is going to be invalidated, because if you allow for more units to be built, smaller lot sizes, it is going to change everything from how many students could potentially be enrolled in the school to the water usage to the landfill. There's really nothing that's not going to get touched by a change in the bylaw, or potentially touched by a change in the bylaws. And if we don't wait for the 2023, then the comprehensive plan will be invalid. A plan that we've paid for will become invalid. Am I off the mark there?
I don't think any development or anything will happen in the amount of time from town meeting to when the comprehensive plan would be done.
But you could conceivably get permits pulled in that amount of time.
You could conceivably, yes.
So if I had a farmer who was willing to sell me, whatever, 50 acres, and I'm going to turn that 50-acre farm into a development, it could happen, conceivably. If it is allowed, that could happen. Assuming that it's not already in agricultural conservation, yada, yada, yada.
Sure. We could make that argument for just about anything. Another thing that could happen is that farmer who's had a difficult time finding people to help them farm goes back to an old model, which is they have a building on their property that part of the worker's payment is room and board, and it may allow for a farmer to stay on that family farm. That is also conceivable.
I would like to see that. That part of this interests me greatly.
Me as well. That's a potentially positive outcome for the farmer that I think helps, create a scenario by which we are supporting local agriculture, et cetera. But rarely is that the potential conceivable idea that folks come up with. It's the negative of somebody could suddenly build a 100-home development and not see how it can literally help people who are saying it's a struggle to hang on to their family farms.
I hear you. I'm not about fear mongering, but I did grow up in a town, very much like Williamstown, where the hill that I went sledding on as a kid is now just a bunch of boxes with cars in the garage, in the driveway, and not even very nice ones. It destroyed the scenery. It destroyed the character of the neighborhood. And it's an eyesore now. And I'm not against development. I know that this town needs housing for sure. It needs housing people can afford to either rent or own. But I do think that there are always going to be those who take advantage of such opportunities for personal gain and don't really so much care about how it affects a town 50 years from now. So that's kind of where I think some people are at, even if they get a little bit henny-penny and the sky is falling. But let me ask you once more to the 15 year, the master plan here is, if this goes through, doesn't that mean we need to have the potential repercussions of this change to the bylaws factored into this 15 year plan? Because otherwise there's really no point in continuing with 15 year plan if that potential change, you know, the minimum potential change and the maximum potential change are not factored in.
And why wouldn't they be factored in?
Because they're nearly done, right? I mean, this plan is, it's been in the works for a long time. There's been research and there's been, I assume, I mean, unless they're just sitting around on their hands and they're just going to whip it out of the last minute. I assume that there's been a lot that has been based on what was expected to be the case in this town. But I don't know that they can just shift gears that quickly and say, oh, okay, well, we'll do this. And, you know, I'm just wondering if that's something that has to be maybe tied to this.
I think it could be tied to it. There could be an addendum to the plan. If the plan is literally 80 or 90% complete, I guess I heard 2023, and that to me is still about 7 months away. That there might be time to add to it or say the plan is going to be 2 months later than we thought because we want to factor this in.
Right. And I think people would be fine with that. Yeah.
Yeah. If people want to factor it in to the plan, I don't see any reason why we would not factor it into the plan.
I brought up school, you know, the possibility of an effect on the number of students that we could have if we had more housing. I mean, let's face it, if the goal is to have more housing, then we can't say, well, we're probably not going to have that much more housing. I mean, if the goal of this RR2 is to create opportunities for housing, and in the meetings that I've listened to or I've watched on Zoom, that seems to be what people are saying. So we can't say, well, you know, we're going to make it possible, but we don't really expect there to be housing, you know, increases. We just built this new school, right? I mean, so there is an effect on the capacity of Mount Greylock. I won't go there right now because, as you say, we don't know what's going to happen. But schools are a huge part of any city or town's budget. In many cases, it is the lion's share of the budget. And I know that the select board does not have a direct hand on the switches and the levers of school committee business. But, you know, you do have the power of the purse. And I'm wondering what your experiences, thoughts on, hopes for the public educational system here in Williamstown is in 2022. Where do you think we are and where do you think we need to be?
Well, so our kids went to West for a couple of years and then we left West at the end of second grade and they went to Pine Cobble through sixth grade. And now we're back in the school district at Mount Greylock. So I'm still kind of winding my way through some of this and working at times to keep my, you know, maternal, overly personal viewpoint separate from being able to look at it a little bit more objectively. I think the building is amazing. I'm mostly pleased with what I see. I know that there are those that believe we could have even more programs and more, I don't know what the word is. You know, given that we're home to Williams College and have an incredible community of professors and their kids and so on, making sure the caliber of the education is exceeds really what we need. I think there's work to be done. I am a fan of the current superintendent. I find him to be personable and accessible and able to hear constructive feedback without immediately getting, defensive. So I'm almost as concerned, and this is in general, this is not specific to Mount Greylock. I'm concerned about the mental health and the emotional health of school kids right now, school age kids. I've seen a little bit of what social media can do even to 12-year-old girls, and I'm not going to lie to you, it's kind of heartbreaking. So I want to make sure that there's enough resources there to balance that along with the academic piece, right? We're all want our kids to get into the best whatever and do the best. I grew up in a family where it was not an option not to go to college. It was not acceptable. My parents didn't go to college. It didn't matter if college was a good fit. It didn't matter. You were going. It's the only thing that counted. And I'm really pleased to see that a little bit of that path is starting to be like, trade school is good. Art school is good. Not everybody's, built for college, and that's okay. So my focus, I think, right now is, while I care deeply about the academics, I want to make sure after 2 years of COVID and what social media is doing to the universe, that school is a safe place for kids and that they're able to have their emotional, needs met. And mental health really is what I'm trying to say, not emotional. I should make sure their emotional needs are met. But I think you get what I'm saying. That is very important to me right now. I don't know if you've seen I think there's been about 16 or 20 college athlete suicides nationwide in the last year or 18 months. And it's kids on the outside who seem to be academic stars, athletic stars, socially involved. They from every angle, they look to be like they're, living their best life, and nobody sees the pain and the stress. So how do we help young people manage that and be able to talk about that and get the help that they need? And I think a lot of that, much like we need a little bit of that look in the police department for mental health issues, I think schools can be a better resource for that.
The last thing that I am going to ask, and then I'm going to open it up to you, is climate mitigation. We are well into a climate catastrophe, and it is coming. There's nothing that we're going to do to stop it. We have apparently blown past the 1.5 degrees Celsius that we could not blow by. 1 degree, 1.5 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels. I should be specific. It's going to happen. It's going to happen in the next 15 years, probably, to maybe 10 years. And there's nothing we can do to stop it. And there's going to be real serious consequences, not just in terms of weather and our own particular climate here, but also in terms of things like climate refugees, some of whom are not going to be, poor. They're going to be very affluent. In fact, they're already here. I've talked to people who've moved here and said they moved here because of Hurricane Sandy and then the pandemic. First it was Sandy, and they said they never want to live through that again. And then the pandemic hit, and they said, forget it, we're out of here. So I would say that for a lot of folks who are looking to relocate to the bookshelf, in fact, there's an article in Wired this month, Wired magazine, about how there are a number of people from affluent areas in the city who are looking to bail into places like the Berkshires. So obviously now that it's in Wired, you can be sure it's going to start happening at Strength. So things are going to change. And we might have to face things like drought here in the Berkshires. We might have to face things like, you know, do we have to grow more of our own food because the Midwest is now a dust bowl and California is on fire, and because of world affairs, we can't count on importing food from South America or China. I mean, these are some questions that they seem abstract until you go to the grocery store and there's something that's like, you know, 50% more than it was last week. What are your thoughts on Williamstown's climate readiness, and what might we do to increase our mitigation strategies?
Wow, that's another big one to unpack.
Those are the only questions I ever bring with me. I'm sorry. It's, you know.
It's okay. I think the work certainly that we've done with conservation is pretty critical. The COOL committee and their work, solar powered, like I'm still so proud of myself for years ago doing solar panels on my house when the first kind of wave of it came through. I keep thinking how proud my dad would be of me for having done that. I mean, I think we have to examine everything, and maybe it's time for a larger look at the bigger things at hand. I hadn't heard a lot about climate refugees. I knew we certainly had an influx post-pandemic, and once everybody figured out that Zoom might really be the answer for a lot of people who no longer wanted to live in a city like New York or Boston. So, hearing you say that, that's one of those moments where it's like, well, yeah, like that makes sense. So I think the folks on the COOL committee, hopefully this is part of the comprehensive plan. You know, what is our natural water supply options? What are we doing to increase that doesn't, you know, do other harm in some form or fashion? Tree growth and making sure we are not unnecessarily over harvesting trees. And if trees have to be harvested, what are we doing with those trees to reuse them? And then, you know, every tree we plant more. I mean, that is such a huge issue that even hearing myself talk about it, I hear overwhelmed in my voice. So I think I'm going to be thinking about this for a long time after we hang up the phone, and I don't have a pat set answer for you, so I'm not going to try to make one up on the fly.
No, that's fine, and I appreciate that. There are no, and this is the beauty of being in a we've never been here as a species before situation. There are no guaranteed solutions. I do know that we have an active agricultural commission, and I suspect that they are going to be absolutely essential members of any conversation that we have about climate readiness and mitigation strategies. If the drought in the south, southwest, and the west continued, New England could be tasked again with providing food for the nation, and I don't know if we're quite ready to do that, although Williamstown, as I said, is in better shape than many. So I just want to leave the floor open to you. There are a number of things that you've discussed that I saw in The Eagle and on WMC with Josh Landis. You brought up a few items. Anything there that you want to talk about, or anything brand new that you would like people to know that is on your agenda if you should snag this fourth term?
Anything brand new? No, although I'm going to be paying a lot more attention to some things thanks to this conversation. So I appreciate that. And I mean that. You know, I am just fiercely committed to this town. It is only the second place that I have ever called home. This is my home. I want to be part of the conversation and the healing. You know, the last 2 years, I showed up every day in every meeting. It was not always easy. It was hard. It's the hardest thing I think I have ever done over any extended period of time. And I've had to do some unnaturally hard things in my life. And I want people to know that I will be here again every single day, trying to listen and learn and make a positive impact where I can and remove negative impacts where I can. And this is absolutely the last time I'm going to run, win or lose. But I do think it's important for people to know that I have a level of tenacity and determination that is really pretty significant. And I think it's to the town's benefit to have somebody like that in that chair for another 3 years.
Well, where can the good people of Williamstown go to find out more about your tenacity and stay up to date with what you've got going on with your campaign? Do you have a website, Facebook page?
I've just been using my personal Facebook page. I don't have the bandwidth to try to set up a separate website or anything between work and kids and other family things going on.
Hear you.
So anybody can look me up on Facebook and you'll see messages. I am planning a 2 listening sessions in the next few days at the log. And you know, me being me, I literally need to go double check because I don't want to mess up what I said or what I've set up. So that should tell you something right there.
Well, what you can do is you can always just get that to me. I'll put it in the show notes when you confirm that up, and
I've got it.
Oh, you've got it. Okay,
go ahead. I just really wanted when I say something important, I really try to make sure I get it right. So this Thursday, from noon until 1:30 at the log, and Monday, May 2nd, from 4:30 to 6 p.m., I'll be in the front room at the log, just hanging out if people want to come by and chat or ask questions or what have you.
You're going to be a special session meeting with seniors, with other candidates at the Harper Center on Friday morning. Isn't that correct?
Friday morning, and then there's an East Vote, some kind of forum on Friday night. I'm not sure yet if we've heard the final. Is it Zoom? Is it live? Is it hybrid? Yeah. So that's Friday evening with all 3 candidates. And tonight is the League of Women Voters candidate forum from 6 to 7:30.
And I think that WillieNet is covering that. Do you know if that's so?
Yes.
Yeah. So I don't think that this will be ready in time for that, unfortunately. But we'll certainly put a link to it. You know, this is going to come out tomorrow morning. So we'll have a link, and I'm sure that WillieNet will get it up. They're usually fast. It'll probably be up by tomorrow morning anyway, so people will get a chance to see that. And I'll put links to your Facebook page, and I'll put the dates that you have that you've offered here, and we'll find out about Friday night as well. So, hey, Jane,
you can put my email address. You can put my email address if you would like.
Which email address is it?
That's Patton, Patton, 721. @yahoo.com.
Well, Jane Patton, it has been a real pleasure to have you on the top left corner here. I know that I kind of kept you in the hot seat for a little bit longer, but I figure, you know, you've got 3 terms under your belt. You're used to it, especially with some of the meetings that you've had to sit through in the last couple of years, 3-hour, 4-hour meetings. This probably seems like a cakewalk. Definitely, if anything else comes up, if you can do any other meet and greets, let us know and we'll update the page, the show notes. But until then, have a great week. And as I do with all candidates, good luck this May.
Thank you very much. And everybody, please, no matter who you vote for, please go vote on May 10th. It matters. Make
rock,
it happen.
Rock on. All right. Take care, Jane.
Thank you. You too. Bye-bye. Bye-bye.
And this concludes this episode, number 157 of the Top Left Corner. And I guess it also concludes this series of interviews that we conducted with the three candidates for Williamstown Select Board. Two seats open, three candidates looking to grab one. I hope that this coverage has given you the insights that you need to determine how you're going to vote. Because really, if long-form journalism can do nothing else, it can give you a well-rounded, comprehensive look into the issues. And that's what we try to do here. So remember to vote May 10th. For now, stay safe, be good to each other, and go easy on yourself. Bye-bye.